If you are just here for House Bill 2020, we are not going to hear that today. And invited testimony, in essence, what I'm going to do is have Mr. Gary up to explain 2003 as sort of the moving party, and then let Mr. Hartman have a chance to speak to the bill, and then I'll let the two of them close after that. And after that's over, Mr. Linden, I believe, is here somewhere. Are they here yet? That doesn't matter. We'll have Mr. Linden or Mr. Nelson want to introduce some amendments. So go ahead, Mr. Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Gary. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Harang Long, Gary Rudnick. And I,
before you get started, Mr. Gary, I just want for David's time to see if we need David Hendrickson here for the. Have you seen all the? You've seen the amendments.
Yes.
Okay. So, do you think you need him for anything, or can I let him know?
I don't think I don't plan to address any of the amendments, which I think are of a technical nature.
Okay. Thanks for all your good work, Mr. Hendricks.
As I said, I'm with the law firm of Harang Long, Gary Rudnick. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to mention the name of the firm twice. I noted that recently in the Eugene Weekly, you described, Mr. Chair, the Harang Long firm as your favorite name for a law firm. Would have been even better if Mr. Long had won the coin toss and the name of the firm was Long Harang.
Quite a bit of evidence of it right now.
I was just going to say I'm going to try to avoid that characterization for my testimony this morning.
Mr. Chair, I'm surprised that Mr. Gary reads the weekly.
What is that?
It's sort of like the Willamette Week. It's an alternative newspaper in Eugene. Okay.
Sorry for the diversion. House Bill 2003 comes to you as the members of the committee are aware after a long and arduous and for many people painful process on the House side. The bill was initially introduced at the request of the various employer groups, including the League of Cities, Associated Oregon Counties, Oregon School Boards Association, Oregon Association of Special Districts, and a coalition of business organization interests that I think pretty much spans the spectrum of business interests. The government and business interests came together because of their conviction that the future of Oregon depends on reining in the costs of PERS. The bill, as it was initially introduced, attempted to honor the commitments that the state and public employers have made to our public employees, as well as to follow the guidelines provided to us by Governor Kulongoski as to the elements of a plan that he would accept. And as I'm sure that you all appreciate, honoring both of those, both the governor's requirements and our best judgment about the requirements of the law, made the process of PERS reform no easy task. The PERS committee on the House side spent literally months looking at every proposed alternative way to address the problems exist in PERS, and in the end, with the intervention of the governor, who had proposals for ways to improve House Bill 2003, the bill that came out of the committee, House Bill 2003A, went out of committee on a 7-1 vote, was approved by the House last week on a 38-20 vote, and thanks to the bipartisan effort to make the bill as good as it could be made, it comes to you as a better product than what was initially introduced. The solution that is proposed in this bill is not pain-free. but we think it has the best possible chance of surviving judicial scrutiny, and that it is as legally defensible as any bill that could have been proposed to effectively address the formidable challenge presented by the escalating costs of PERS. I've submitted to you written testimony as well as a section-by-section description of what the bill does. I'm not going to repeat all of that. I would like, however, to take a minute to talk about the three main components of the bill. Section 1 of the bill eliminates the PERS members' obligation to contribute 6% of their salary to the PERS system. And it probably by now is no longer as counterintuitive to think that that would produce savings as it was when the idea first surfaced. By eliminating the requirement of an employee contribution, of course, the bill puts 100% of the responsibility for financing the PERS system on the public employer. But at the same time, it also will have the effect of slowing the future growth of member accounts. And by slowing the future growth of member accounts, it will reduce the fiscal impact of the money match benefit, which effectively provides that at retirement, the member's benefit is calculated by taking the amount of money in their account and doubling it, and then creating an annuity over the expected life expectancy of the member. Now, the elimination of the member contribution has ripple effects throughout the system, of course, because it has been a critical component of the way the system was set up. And one of the most obvious impacts of eliminating the employer contribution is the impact that it has on what's known as the employer pickup. As you know, the statutes today provide that public employers may agree either through collective bargaining or by voluntary assumption of the obligation, they may agree to pay the 6% contribution on behalf of employees. And many, many public employers, including the state of Oregon, have agreed to pick up the member contribution. In order to avoid the difficulties related to collective bargaining that existed, frankly, in House Bill 2003 as it was originally proposed, House Bill 2003A simply provides that for a transition period, the employees will contribute no longer to PERS, but to what is called in the bill a transition account, effectively something like a 401k. And it also provides that any public employer who, on the effective date of the act, is picking up the employee contribution will be required to continue to make the contribution to this transition account for at least the next biennium. The second main component of the bill is the provisions that were added at the request of the governor's office to deal with the problem of excess income crediting to member accounts. As you all know, for Tier 1 members, those that are in the system, were in the system prior to January 1 of 1996, a statute, ORS 238.255, provides that member accounts shall be credited with at least the assumed earnings rate. The assumed earnings rate is what the PERS fund is expected to earn, according to the actuary's calculations, over a long period of time. And, of course, we all know that earnings will be up and down in some years, and that the assumption is that over time it will balance out. Currently, the assumption is 8%, and that means that under the statute, member accounts must be credited with 8%. However, in the 1990s, and actually ever since the guaranteed rate of return was adopted in 1975, in years when the PERS fund has earned greater than the assumed rate, it has been the practice of the PERS board to credit substantial amounts of the excess earnings to member accounts. In the Lipscomb decision, Judge Lipscomb concluded with regard to the 1999 earnings, when Tier 1 member accounts, regular accounts, were credited with 20%. Judge Lipscomb concluded that the PERS board had abused its discretion by crediting an excess amount of earnings and not setting aside sufficient amounts in reserve accounts to deal with the down years. This bill deals with that problem in two ways. First of all, in Section 8 of the bill provides that no Tier 1 member, when they retire, will have a PERS account that is less than the total of the accumulated contributions of the member plus interest credited on the member's account at the assumed rate. So it preserves the commitment that was made in ORS 238.255. At the same time, it deals with the excess of earnings that have been credited to member accounts, not by requiring that those accounts be reallocated, but by providing that the deficit that has grown in the fund as a result of crediting 8% to member accounts in 2000 and 2001 and soon to be 2002, years when the fund did not earn the assumed rate, created a deficit, and members that are Tier 1 members will not receive interest crediting on their accounts until that deficit is retired. The bill further provides that member accounts in Tier 1 will not be credited with earnings in excess of actual earnings, except to the extent that there is actually money in reserves to cover the crediting up to the assumed rate. That, taken together with the guarantee floor that is provided by the bill, means that, in effect, member accounts, to the extent that they have excess earnings credited above the assumed rate, will act as their own sort of gain-loss reserve until the PERS fund is balanced out. Also, because of, frankly, simple fairness, there is a judicial finding that the 1999 earnings in particular were unlawfully credited. According to PERS' own policy, rather than crediting 20%, they should have credited something in the neighborhood of 11.8%, with the balance going into a gain-loss reserve to cover down years. If a member retires prior to the time that...
Mr. Perry, did you say unlawful?
With respect to 1999, Judge Lipscomb has determined that the crediting of earnings was unlawful and has sent it back for those earnings to be reallocated.
But he used the term unlawful?
Yes.
Okay.
So the problem of what do you do with people who retired already after the 1999 earnings were credited and before any adjustments are made through future earnings adjustments, as I've just described, what this bill provides is that a member who has already retired and received a larger benefit as a result of those excess earnings credited in 1999 will continue to receive their full benefit, but their benefit will be frozen until their true benefit, together with the COLA, equals the amount that they're receiving. So it's a cost of living adjustment freeze. And that applies to a very narrow group of members who retire before there's any adjustment made to their account out of future earnings and after the 1999 earnings have been credited. The third thing that the bill does is provide a remedy for other errors identified by Judge Lipscomb in the City of Eugene versus PERS case. There were two or three other areas where the judge found that benefits had been unlawfully and improperly calculated, and the order simply sends the case back to PERS for them to recalculate the rates, but he makes it clear that the PERS board is not to charge employers for the cost of those benefits that exceed what the law provides. And that presents a problem for PERS because they only have really two sources of money. They either get the money from contributions or they get it from earnings. Currently, in the statutes, the only remedy that would be available to address that is provided in ORS 238.715, which authorizes PERS to go back and recoup from members any benefits in excess of what the law provides that are paid to them. Rather than what that somewhat drastic remedy, this bill provides that the PERS board will also be authorized to use two mechanisms to recover the cost of those benefits without charging them to employers. One is to pay for the benefits out of future earnings, and the other is by withholding cost of living adjustments to members whose benefits are higher than they legally should be. That section of the bill will only apply if PERS is actually, in fact, required to implement the Lipscomb decision. So it will abide the ultimate ruling of the court. I will speak briefly to the issue of the constitutionality or legality of House Bill 2003A. And the first thing that I will tell you is that no one can tell you whether all or a portion of this bill may be found wanting in some legal way by a court. What you will hear are merely lawyers' opinions as to what a court will do. And you will hear from others, including Mr. Hartman in a minute, that 2003A will breach or impair the contract between public employers and public employees, and thus it violates the state and federal constitution. I will point out to you that Mr. Hartman and the others that will tell you that are the same people that will tell you that anything that this body does that has the effect of reducing projected future benefits, not accrued benefits, but what the actuary projects benefits will be in the future, anything that does that would be a breach of contract. And it is simply a fact that it is impossible to reduce the cost of the system without reducing projected future benefits. And so the argument really is that this body is powerless to do anything to address the problem. We don't accept that view. We think that that you are not helpless in this matter. And really, the fundamental legal analysis is not an area where Mr. Hartman and I disagree. We agree that there are contract rights that are involved here. We agree that the state has an obligation to honor its contractual promises to public employees. The place where we part company is in analyzing two critical questions. What are the terms of that agreement? What is the contract? And what is the impact of the bill on the contract? We're going to talk, I'm sure, primarily, you're going to hear talk primarily about the 6% withholding and that that's a breach of contract and that the changes on the guaranteed rate of return are a breach of contract. Our view is that they do not breach contract rights for two distinct reasons. First question is, does a requirement that employees contribute 6% of their income to fund their retirement constitute a contractual promise that they will forever be entitled to contribute 6% to the PERS fund? We view the statute that requires employees to contribute 6% not as a contractual promise, but the imposition of an obligation on those members. And so therefore, you never get to the point of asking whether the elimination of the 6% is a breach because it is not simply is not part of the contractual promise that was that is included in the PERS contract. There's not any real disagreement that ORS 238.255, the guaranteed rate of return, is a part of the contract. In fact, the Supreme Court in the Ospoa case has already held that it is. But the question is, what is the promise that was made? And the courts tell us that in order to determine what the contract is, one must go back and look at what the legislature intended when it passed the statute that is being considered to be a statutory contractual promise. ORS 238.255 became a part of the statutes in 1975, I believe, and it became a part of the statute after two bad earnings years when little or nothing was credited to member accounts. And at the time, a member's retirement benefit was affected pretty directly by how much money was credited to the account. And various representatives of PERS members came to the legislature and said, you know, it's not really fair that a member's retirement benefit should be affected by the economic circumstances in the immediate years before when they retire. If it's a, you know, good economy, they'll have a nice retirement. If it's a bad economy, they'll have a less nice retirement. We know that the fund is expected to earn this assumed rate over a period of time. Why don't we just provide that we will always credit that assumed rate? And so it was intended to be a mechanism by which you could smooth the spikes and drops in earnings. That was the legislature's intent in enacting it, and that smoothing effect is completely preserved by House Bill 2003A, because, as I've said, no member who is a Tier 1 member subject to that guarantee will retire with an account balance that is less than the assumed rate credited to the member's account for the life of the account. What 2003 focuses on is the excess earnings, and let me just point out the history of the last 5 years. In the last decade, or between 1995 and 2000, the PERS board credited 12.5% in 1995, 21% in 1996, 18.7% in 1997, 14.1% in 1998, and 20% in 1999. The effect of those practices over a five-year period was to more than double the size of a member's account, and obviously to credit far in excess of what the fund is expected to earn over a long period of time. Not surprisingly, when we hit the down years of 2000, when the fund earned 0.63%, and 2001, when the fund earned a negative 7%, and 2002, when the fund earned more than negative 8%, the money was not there in reserve accounts to pay the guaranteed rate of return. The reason it wasn't in the reserve accounts was because it was in the member accounts. And that's the problem that this bill is intended to address. In our view, it does not breach a contractual promise to credit member accounts with at least the assumed rate. House Bill 2003A was crafted to take only the steps that are necessary to put the PERS train back on its intended track. It preserves the core benefits and promises, and it corrects the errors that threaten to derail PERS. PERS members, at least Tier 1 members, will still have two very important guarantees. Number one, every PERS member, Tier 1 and Tier 2, has the guaranteed floor of a retirement equal to the full formula benefit that this body adopted in 1981. And I should point out, when you adopted it in 1981, you intended for that to be the benefit that people would receive. And number two, people that are members of Tier 1 will continue to have the guarantee that they will, their account will earn over the life of their career at least the assumed rate of return. I'd be happy to address any questions that the committee may have.
I have some, Mr. Chair, when you're ready.
Go ahead, Senator. Well, I have just one question. On the 8% over the life of the plan, I'm still trying to understand that with regards to, for instance, an employee hired in the last 2 years where there's been negative earnings. So with the floor of zero, there would have been no crediting to the account, but if the employee works for 30 years, you're going to go back and look at every year the employee worked and then do the 8% assumption?
Mr. Chair, you would if that member was Tier 1, but if he joined the,
well, that's
the,
right, it wouldn't
in
be
the last
one,
2 years, he would be Tier 2.
Okay,
and
then let's
no
take a Tier 1 and hired in 90, last, would it have to be hired in 95? Would have 8 years in the system, and would have. I know that there's, you know, had, if they were in the variable versus the fixed, there would be a difference. But
right.
assuming that they were in the fixed for the purposes of this discussion, would you envision that what this bill would do would be to look, and the worker works 22 more years, that that worker's crediting would look at the 8% per year, so the 4 years of 96 through 99 when it was an average of about 18.5%, that you would calculate that in terms of giving them the 8% overall?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the way it will work is that over the life of a person's career, regardless of when they started work, if they're Tier 1, each year the amount of interest that will be credited will be determined by the statute that says if there's a deficit account, they get credited with zero, and if there is less than 8% earnings, they get credited only with so much as reserves will permit them to be credited. But then at the point of retirement, PERS would do, in effect, a look back, and they would look at the account balance that the member actually has in their account as a result of the crediting over the years. And then they would look at what that member's account would be had that member been credited with the assumed earnings rate in each year that he or she worked. Whichever is greater is the amount that will be used for calculating the member's benefit. So people who are close to retirement now and are going to retire in the next few years will not have earnings credited to their account until that deficit is retired, but they will in all likelihood still have an account balance that is greater than the total of assumed interest rate credited on their account over years. So they'll get the benefit of those excess earnings in the calculation of their benefit. Somebody who, in your hypothetical, who started in 95, depending on what happens with the economy in the future, may have very little interest credited to their account, but when they retire, they will get the benefit of the assumed rate, whatever that assumed rate is at various times, for the life of their career.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gary, this bill becomes effective July 1, 2003, correct?
Yes.
There is no delayed implementation of this bill, is there?
There are different provisions in the bill that that take effect at different times, but the bill becomes effective on July 1, 2003.
Okay. My question is in regard to that is I'm sitting here reviewing the fiscal analysis of the proposed legislation, and there are a number of costs to this bill. Have you seen this fiscal analysis?
I'm not sure that I have.
I'll just share a few things with you. It says there's a cost. Cost to PERS is not yet determinable because PERS has not had time to review the amendment to develop administrative costs to implement provisions of the bill. It is expected that additional expenditure limitation and or position authority will be needed to implement provisions of the bill. I know you can't speak to that, but I just wanted you to know that's in the fiscal. Additionally, there are potential costs to the state treasurer. And also, since the bill provides that administrative costs be borne by members' accounts, the treasurer can seek additional expenditure limitation through ways and means. So the members' accounts will bear the cost of this administrative change. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, the PERS fund is a closed system, and by statute, the administrative expenses of administering the fund are paid first out of income earned by the fund, not just income earned on member accounts, but income earned on all accounts. Mm-hmm. And in the event that there is insufficient income in a given year to cover the administrative expenses of the fund, then it becomes a cost that is borne by the contributing employers.
Okay.
I want to point out that your you're quite correct that there will be an impact, a cost associated with implementing this bill, because it requires the PERS staff and the treasurer's staff to do things that they're not mm-hmm. currently doing. The administrative costs of implementing this bill or of administering the system in general is a minuscule amount compared to the cost of the system, main cost driver being obviously the payment of benefits. And the savings that are realized in this bill in terms of the actuary's estimate of projected future costs of the system are, as you know, quite dramatic. And while it does potentially require that there will be increased expenditure limitation, as you know, that does not involve any general fund dollars.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, if I could just continue.
Senator Walker.
A couple more, thank you. Also, you would agree, would you not, Mr. Gary, that should this go to the Supreme Court, which we've all agreed, I think I've heard everyone say that it will go there, that should the court find the action we've taken here to be illegal, unlawful, that any resulting award will include payment, repayment, and damages costing the state and the PERS system a great deal of money. Would you not agree?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I would not agree with that. I've heard it said that the risks associated with passing this bill and then having the court rule that it is invalid is somehow greater than the costs that one might incur if we do nothing. But at least the way I analyze it, when a person proves that someone else breached a contract, what they are entitled to in the way of damages is to be made whole, that is to receive what they would have received had the contract not been breached. And so the effect of the court invalidating all or a portion of this bill would be simply to return us to the status quo before the bill was passed. That is, it puts us back where we are. And to be sure, if members received less money in retirement than they were entitled to, such as cost of living adjustments that they should have received that they were not entitled to, then PERS would be obligated to pay them the money that is due together with interest. But the amount of damages will be calculated based upon what they would have received had this bill not passed. And so apart from the transaction costs associated with fighting about whether the bill is legal and then the interest costs for the delayed payments, which presumably is offset by the fact that the fund will have the use of the money in the meantime, I don't think that there are dramatic risks of additional costs being incurred. There is the risk that the legislature will act on the assumption that this bill will be upheld and make commitments to spend money that, when the bill is invalidated, it would, you know, mean that you've agreed to spend money that it now turns out that you don't have. That's that's an issue that the Ways and Means people have to wrestle with as to how much you assume savings will be produced in the first year of the biennium. But the ultimate cost is a cost that will be borne by the public employers, and it will be no different significantly than the cost that is borne if this body does nothing.
So, Mr. Gary, you would agree then. I had an opportunity this weekend when I was home to read the Northwest Labor Press, their May 2 edition. And in here, Mr. Hartman had taken issue with remarks that you made to the committee on PERS in the House, that the courts eventually struck down this law, you said Oregon would simply revert back to PERS as it is now. And so you would agree with that statement, that we just go back to where we are right now should the court find that what we've done here is unlawful?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I'm astonished to learn that Mr. Hartman disagreed with me. I don't think that's what I had said, and I think that's a somewhat imprecise characterization of what would happen. In the event that the court rules that House Bill 2003A is invalid, what would happen is that the court would order the state or PERS to restore anyone who was harmed by virtue of the implementation of House Bill 2003A to the position that they would have been in had House Bill 2003A not become law. So, as I said, if somebody didn't get a COLA that they were entitled to, we'll be obligated to pay the COLA. If somebody got a reduced benefit compared to what they were legally entitled to under the Supreme Court, they will be entitled to be paid the benefit that they should have had. But that will be no different than the position that we're in if this body does nothing, because as things stand now, we will have to pay those benefits as they're being calculated by PERS under the status quo.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Geary. Those are my questions. I appreciate your responses.
Actually, Senator Walker, within that article, if you want to ask Mr. Geary also about the fact that if he can distinguish, as Mr. Hartman did, between impairment of contract and, what was the other term?
Breach.
Breach.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly esoteric issue, Mr. Chair, but as a general proposition, when the legislature, an impairment of contract is a constitutional provision that says the legislature shall not impair the obligation of contract. So if you and I, as private citizens, enter into a contract, the legislature, as a general rule, cannot pass a law that says that Tony Corcoran is not required to honor his contract with Bill Geary. And normally you see impairments. Yeah, it's a good thing that that's there, because it makes me feel safe. But ordinarily you see an impairment in a situation where the state is not a party to the contract but is passing a law that has the effect of impairing a contract between third parties. There, it is also possible that the legislature can impair a contract. In this case, the court has said, for reasons that I don't fully understand, that the legislature passes the PERS statutes, but the contract is a contract between the public employer and the public employee. So it's the contract between the city of Portland and the public employee, and when the legislature passes a statute that changes the terms of the contract, the court has said that is an impairment of contract between the employer and the employee. It is also possible for the legislature to pass a statute, and I don't think House Bill 2003 does that, that says we're not changing the contract, we're just deciding that we're going to ignore the contract, we're going to breach it. And in those cases, the transfer of money from Safe Corporation back in 1981 being an example, where the legislature took $81 million out of the Safe Fund, the court said that's a breach of contract because the legislature promised Safe employers that money was going to be used to pay for workers' comp benefits, and they at least initially did not say that means you got to give the money back. What they said was you've got to compensate the employers for any injury that they suffered as a result of that breach. So I know a much longer explanation than you were looking for, but it is a fairly complicated area.
Senator Beyer, are you lost?
Yeah.
Okay. You weren't here to speak, were you? I didn't think so. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions, Senator Menace? No. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hartman.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Greg Hartman. I'm here representing the PERS Coalition, and probably does not come as a huge surprise to this committee for me to tell you that we oppose House Bill 2003. We do that both because we think it's a breach of faith with the public employees all over the state in terms of changing commitments which were made to them, and we also believe that it is a breach of their contractual rights. I appreciate Mr. Geary's artful discussion of why he does not believe this is a breach of contract, but I think he's really going through an exercise of ignoring the obvious. I'm handing up a copy of a letter that I sent to your chairman about a week or 10 days ago, and if I can explain that letter just very briefly, and I'm not going to go through it in great detail, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Counsel, as you all know, had written an opinion letter even before that expressing his concern that some portions of House Bill 2003 as it then existed were in fact either impairments or breaches of contract. And Mr. Gary took issue with that, and this was in part a response to Mr. Gary's letter. But I decided instead of me giving you a lot of analysis, all I would really do is quote from the court's language itself. And so basically what you have here is a compilation of quotes taken directly from the court's own statements, primarily from the Hughes case, because what the court did in Hughes, which was the tax case, was to go back and review the laws that it developed over the many years and lifted various quotes out of a number of cases going all the way back to 1940, and I simply quoted those quotes. So 90% of this letter is not me speaking, it's the court simply speaking about what the law is in the state of Oregon. And if I can read a quote from page 4, because I think it summarizes, and this is in fact from the Oregon State Police Officer's case, summarizes the law in the state. The court in that state said, and this is at page 377-78, once the employee performs services in reliance on the employer's promise to afford a particular benefit on retirement, the employer is contractually bound to honor that obligation. The key word in that sentence, and the word that you will see repeated over and over and over in the quotations that I've taken from the courts, is the word benefit. As I said, I appreciate Mr. Gary's discussion of contract rights, but it is really much simpler than he makes it out to be. And that is that if a benefit has been promised, then there is a commitment to provide that benefit. And really that, in a nutshell, is exactly what the Supreme Court has said in many, many cases since 1940. As an aside, if I can for a minute, my understanding is that the chairman has, or through the caucuses or perhaps through the leadership, I'm not sure exactly how that all works, has requested an opinion from the Attorney General's office, which I had hoped would be here for your review today. Apparently it is not, is apparently expected shortly. So rather than focusing on my view of the law or Mr. Gary's view of the law, since we are here as advocates, I would suggest very strongly that you consider the opinions of both Mr. Chamoff and ultimately whatever opinion, though I've not seen it, that you get from the Attorney General. What House Bill 2003 does, and let's step back from the various mechanisms for how it does it, is to basically take away, and don't hold me to this exact figure, but some amount, I think in excess of $6 billion of benefits which have been promised to public employees, and provides that those benefits will not be paid. I mean, no one's making any trying to cover up the fact that the purpose of House Bill 2003 is to save money. As Mr. Gary said, it's a closed system. The only way you save money is by not paying benefits that have been promised. We believe that any bill, no matter how artfully crafted, no matter how carefully constructed, which takes away $6 billion of benefits which have been promised to public employees, will be held to be either an impairment or a breach of their contractual rights. And I don't think you have to go through any analysis that's a whole lot more complex than that to come to the conclusion, if you read through some of these quotations, which have come from about 65 years of Oregon cases on that topic. I can discuss the various provisions, happy to do that. You know, the 6% solution, which takes away the right or obligation, depending on how you look at it, of making employee contributions. And Mr. Gary suggests, well, there's nothing in that language which makes it contractual, but he's looking in the wrong place. Because the purpose of doing away with the 6% contribution, as is acknowledged, is to basically do away with money match. And money match, which is embedded in the system, has been in the system since 1945, was put back into the system in 1969 and remained the minimum benefit when this body constructed the full formula in 1981, has been there all that time. And it is contractual in nature, and if you look at the language, it is specifically promissory in nature. And by the way, the term promissory in nature is one that the Supreme Court used in the Hughes case when looking at the tax statute, which was at issue in that case. Same with the 8% guarantee. We've already been to the Supreme Court once on that. That was as a result of the passage of ballot measure 8, Mr. Sizemore's reform measure. And the court held that that was contractual in nature and found that the enactment which attempted to take it away was, in fact, an impairment of contract and therefore void. As far as Judge Lipscomb is concerned, Mr. Gary and I obviously disagree about Judge Lipscomb's findings. Those are on appeal. Those will ultimately work their way through the system. And one of us are right and one of us will turn out to be wrong, or perhaps a combination of both on Judge Lipscomb. But I think there's a tremendous danger for this body to base its decision on how to go forward based on a case which has not gone through the full judicial process. I suspect that you're allowing yourself to be in a circumstance where you are dependent on Judge Lipscomb's opinion in a way that perhaps you don't want to be. So all of these things, again, I can go through the details or answer questions, but if you step back from this and look at the big picture is $6 billion of benefits, which were promised, are not going to be paid. And that's basically the way that we see House Bill 2003. Mr. Gary has suggested it's better to do something than nothing, that there's, while there is some risk in doing something, it's not a great risk. I don't disagree with his analysis. I think if the court does say that what you've done is a breach of contract, essentially the remedy will be putting people back where they were, plus whatever interest is incurred, accrued. But there is one other thing that I would caution you about, and that is that, and I guess we call it particularly in this business, the law of unintended consequences, because I think in some measures, if you pass this bill, you may actually be enhancing the benefit of Tier 2 PERS participants. And if you do that, if this body decides to pass that, and here I'm referring specifically to the 6% issue, you may find that you have made a promise to those people which you will not be permitted to take back. I've referred to this in other contexts because this has come up before in discussions of changes of pension plans, not just in PERS, as, you know, the best of both worlds kind of circumstance. Because, for instance, if you pass this statute and it affects some people by lowering their benefit, and the court says you may not do that, well, then presumably that benefit's going to go back up to whatever it started out at. But if one of the consequences of your passage of this is to raise people's benefit, and I think that likely happens with Tier 2, the court is not necessarily going to allow you to take that back. So as you study this bill and decide whether you really want to go forward with it, I would suggest that in addition to the transaction costs, the potential damages which may accrue, that you may also have some unintended consequences of this bill, which would go far beyond whatever attempt you're making to fix the problem, and may actually make the problem worse from the sense of trying to save some money. I've heard the suggestion made that the state has to do this because they're economically, we're in very difficult times. We acknowledge that. We don't dispute that. We don't believe that PERS caused those economically difficult times. We all know those are caused by forces much bigger than PERS. And we all recognize that moving forward and carrying out the PERS commitments is going to be expensive to the state and local employers, at least in the short term. Is that sufficient justification to set aside the promise? Is it sufficient for the legislature to say it has become extremely difficult for us to make this payment, so we have to rethink it? Quite frankly, we've been researching for months. We can find no case anywhere in the United States that suggests that a legislature in a circumstance similar to where we are in the state of Oregon can simply set aside its promises on the basis that it has become difficult financially to carry out those promises. The second thing I would point out to you, if you really think that Oregon is in such dire straits that it must begin breaching or impairing its contracts, then shouldn't we see contracts other than this particular contract being considered for impairment? I think over on the House side,
we have with the Staley decision.
Pardon me?
We have with the Staley decision, for example.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the Staley decision.
It was a decision to support developmentally disabled when they deinstitutionalized them, and there was a subsequent lawsuit on the agreement that was made. So, but I do want you to speak to the issue of the PERS coalition. I was told yesterday could have reached $4 billion in savings. How could they have done that differently than this bill proposes?
There are two major pieces of litigation that the, let me rephrase that. The PERS Coalition supported House Bill 2001, which was passed very early in the session, and my recollection is that House Bill 2001 saved about 1.5% on employer rates. I don't recall the number that was attached to it. The PERS Coalition has consistently supported the imposition of new actuarial tables, so long as it's done in a way that protects members' accrued rights. And again, my recollection is that that would have saved somewhere in excess of $500 million, but less than $1 billion. Again, without having the numbers in front of me, I don't recall.
You're getting a nod from Mr. Delaney.
Okay, so I'm at least in the ballpark.
Right.
And we indicated a willingness to discuss other issues and to consider other changes, but the two that we were upfront in supporting would have made a substantial impact, immediate impact on rates. As a matter of fact, the 4% or 4.5%, which is the average increase in rates going into effect July 1st, assuming no legislative action, would have been more than cut in half based on at least those two proposals, which we supported up front. So it is not true to say that we have not supported any proposals which would save money. We simply can't support a proposal like this, which quite frankly digs so deeply into the PERS system and into the benefits that have been promised that we cannot support it. And let me, if I may, Mr. Chairman, point out to you that there's another concern, and that is we have a well-developed body of case law in the state of Oregon which tells us what pension contract rights mean. Mr. Gary and I may disagree about exactly how to interpret it, but nonetheless it exists. My question is, if the legislature passes House Bill 2003 in this session, then what is the new law, the new legal protection which exists for public employees all over the state in terms of their protection of their pension benefits? In other words, what do I tell my clients the day on July 2nd, 2003? What is their protected benefit? Do I tell them that if the legislature finds in the year 2005 that because of additional fiscal difficulty they must take some more out of the pension, that's okay? I'm struggling to find a unifying thought behind 2003, which nonetheless, while taking away money, says, but we're still going to protect something. And quite frankly, I can't find that unifying thought. I can't find the new legal theory of protection of contract rights. And so for my clients, when they look at 2003, not only do they see the enormous bite being taken out of promised benefits, but they're saying to themselves, where is the new theory of pension contract law which prevent the next legislature and the legislature after that and right on down the road to determine that they would not pay promised benefits because they're fiscally difficult perhaps to pay? So we find it a very troublesome bill. And I said this over on the House side. If there was a clearly articulated pension policy behind all this, other than saving money, because we understand that's the exercise here, then we could at least look at that policy and say, does that make sense for our members in the long term? But I can't find that. The only unifying principle I find behind 2003, as I say, is the desire to save some money. So we oppose the bill. We do think that it will likely be overturned on appeal. I agree with Mr. Gary. None of us can give you 100% assurances one way or the other of how that litigation will come out. But again, I would encourage you to, if not to read my letter, which obviously I would encourage you to do, but to look at the two cases referenced in here, the Hughes case and the Oregon State Police case, because I think they will give you a summary of the law in this area, and I would hope in light of that summary you would understand why we feel that the changes contemplated by House Bill 2003 are very likely to run afoul of the court's protection of pension benefits.
Thank you. Senator Minnis.
Mr. Hartman, all of your comments seem to assume that the PERS board acted prudently and met their fiduciary responsibility with respect to the management of the PERS system.
Senator Minnis, I don't know that I would necessarily say that, but I do believe that the PERS board did act responsibly. I do disagree with Mr. Gary in his analysis that they somehow dropped the ball over many years. So I agree with your thought, although I wasn't sure it was an underpinning to my comments.
Well, and I'm thinking of, well, it seems to be an underlying assumption that, because inherent in the PERS system is the management, the fiduciary responsibility that the board has by statute to manage the various accounts, not only the member accounts, but the loss reserves, and et cetera. The assumption being that you have a whole system that is going to survive in perpetuity, and that those benefits that you suggest are absolutely guaranteed will, in fact, be there at some point in the future. And it appears to me that you have to look at the system as a whole and look at the responsibility and duty of the board. That's where it gets me back to Lipscomb, where I think Lipscomb very clearly said that, in his opinion, that the board did not or should not have credited those monies to the account, but rather should have put them in the reserve. So I guess the question for me is, how guaranteed would you suggest a benefit is if it's derived from some illegal or use the term illegal, all that kind of stretch decision by the board, and it's the interplay of the money that is accrued to the accounts that really derives the ultimate benefit. I think hopefully you understand where I'm going.
Yes.
Maybe I
yes.
don't.
No. What Judge Lipscomb actually decided was that insofar as 99 earnings were concerned, it was an abuse of discretion for the board to have made the full 20% distribution to member accounts. Judge Lipscomb didn't go beyond that. He didn't say what he thought the correct figure was. As a matter of fact, he simply sent it back to the board to say, think about it again, make your decision, and this time be much more clear with how you make your decision, because the judge in part faulted the board for simply not articulating their reason for doing what they did. I will suggest to you, and I will suggest to the court on appeal, that Judge Lipscomb engaged in what we usually know as Monday morning quarterbacking, or 20/20 hindsight. I think the record, in fact, was there was no record to support the idea that if we go back to March of 2000, which was when those decisions were made, that there was anything before the board at that time which would have suggested that they were acting imprudently. I think Judge Lipscomb just applied some 20/20 hindsight. Now, if you ask me today, sitting here in 2003 and utilizing 20/20 hindsight, should the board have been more conservative? My response is obviously so. You don't get to go back and make those decisions typically based on 20/20 hindsight. And for the many, many years before 1999, when the board made those distributions, you might recall the statute requires them, prior to making a distribution, to report them to the legislature. And so if the board was off the farm, so to speak, or basically acting in a way which was imprudent, they were certainly reporting that year in and year out to the legislature, and never during that period of time was there a suggestion from the legislature that the board had somehow embarked on a policy which was inconsistent with what the legislature wanted them to do.
All right. Thank you.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Hartman, I appreciated your comment about these are difficult economic times, and we're trying to fix them by going after the PERS system. I wanted to take something out of an article. Oregon has been somewhat illuminated lately in the New York Times. And there was another article in the New York Times yesterday, The Faces of Budget Cuts, written by Bob Herbert. And he said that Oregon is one of many states caught in a fiscal quagmire. There are many reasons for the budgetary distress which has spread from coast to coast. They include a lousy national economy, a widespread unwillingness locally and nationally to levy the taxes necessary to support government services, and the refusal of the Bush administration to help state and local governments that are experiencing their worst budget shortfalls since World War II. Would you agree with that statement? I'm sort of getting that from you, that, you know, we're in a crisis here in the state, and we seem to have an emphasis that it's the PERS system that's causing the crisis. Would you agree that there's more at work than just the retirement accounts and the failure of the PERS board to actually do some things?
If I may, Senator Walker, let me answer that in two parts. First of all, yes, I do agree. I mean, it's obvious that the economic difficulties that the state of Oregon is suffering are from a variety of causes, ranging all the way from difficulties in the American economy that none of us can do a thing about, that are going to have to cure themselves, so however that's going to happen, to problems with our own method of raising revenue, which I think everybody would acknowledge to a greater or lesser extent, that we do have problems with how we raise our money. Now, to the extent that if we turn and flip over and talk about the PERS system, PERS really is not substantially different from any other defined benefit pension program, whether public or private, in the United States, which is heavily invested in the stock market. Every pension plan has taken a beating. I mean, we all know that. Quite frankly, we have been tracking around the country and looking at what's happening in other states. And while PERS is certainly unique and has its own unique issues, and I would be the first to admit that, much of the problem that we're experiencing here in the state of Oregon is, in fact, caused by simply a downturn in the market. I have yet to find any other state that is contemplating the kind of substantial change in their pension system comparable to what's being discussed in House Bill 2003, despite the fact that many other states are suffering not only problems with their pension systems brought on by the difficulties in the market, but also the same shortfalls in revenue brought on by these national factors. Now, I can't say I've done a survey of all 50 states, but I've been trying to track this carefully, and I have yet to find any other state that is reacting the same way as the state of Oregon in terms of the attempt to seriously cut back on the benefits which have been promised in our state pension plan.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up again.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Hartman, I have another article. I've been prolific in my reading lately. From the Seattle Times, dated April 30, 2003, and the tagline is 15 biggest Northwest pension funds short $9.5 billion. So you're correct. This is not a problem simply with our pension system. It is a problem nationwide, I believe, even with private companies. And one of the things they talk about in the article is that we must examine every available option to strengthen the pension insurance program for the long term. One option is to raise the premium employers pay to fund the insurance, but employers oppose that, and I think that's why we're here. Another one is to engage in smoothing, which the PERS board, we've had discussion about how they do that. And there was agreement that falling stocks have drained the big pools of money. But there was a comment here, and I don't know if you can comment on it. They said there's another more arcane factor at work. Low interest rates in the present cause the estimated future cost of pension benefits to balloon, and interest rates are at their lowest in four decades. I don't know if that applies to Oregon's system, but I think that's something that's been overlooked in terms of how the interest rates have affected pension plans.
Senator Walker, in response, I think that's an interesting observation. I don't know whether it applies directly to the Oregon plan, because in terms of the interest expectation that we have had in the state of Oregon, established by the board through the advice of the actuary, that has been at 8% since 1989, so that has not changed. It is clear, and I think Mr. Johnson has testified to this over on the House side, and may well have before your committee, but I didn't happen to be here. It is true that if he were to lower that assumption, in other words, if he were to determine his best estimates say is 7% in the long haul over the next 30 or 40 years, it would have a very serious impact on employer rates, because now we would be assuming that the block of money which has been set aside to pay retirees, usually called the Benefits Enforced Reserve, which is a very, very large component of PERS, isn't going to earn as much money as we thought it was. And so basically you'd need more money set aside because of the lower earnings expectation to pay what's already been promised to those people who've already retired. Now, we haven't seen that phenomenon yet in the state of Oregon, and I'll knock on wood here and hope that we don't, because obviously we all hope that the economy, the market, and everything comes back, not only which will help cure the purse problem, but also help with the economic problems which have caused so much of Oregon's financial difficulties. So that one hasn't gotten us yet, I don't think.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate your responses to my question.
Thank you.
I guess the other thing that I read in the Oregonian Julie Tripp's article this weekend was that there's $7 trillion of value lost in the stock market in 3 years. I mean, I think it's no wonder we're in an economic crisis.
Mr. Chairman, I don't even know how many zeros there are in a trillion, but I think there's a whole bunch of them.
And I'm Irish. It's even harder for me. Mr. Gary, would you like to come up? And I guess you can just stay there, Mr. Herman. You two do talk to each other, don't you?
From time to time, and we occasionally even agree.
Okay.
We always celebrate when we find something to agree upon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, it is, I think, a serious mischaracterization of the situation to say that simply the exercise that's going on here is an attempt to save money by scapegoating PERS, or that the changes that are being proposed in House Bill 2003 are being proposed because we need to find some money somewhere. You all are painfully aware that if this bill passes, it will not begin to deal with the economic woes that the state wrestles with and that every employer in the state, public and private, is wrestling with now. The fact of the matter is that there's another side to the equation, and that's a critical thing that needs to be considered, and that is that the benefits that are being projected to be paid to PERS members are seriously out of whack with what the legislature ever intended members to receive. You all know, and I hasten to point out, not every PERS member is getting rich off of the system. In fact, most PERS members are not. People that retired before 1997 or 1995 have, in most cases, retired under the full formula. And many, many Tier 2 people will not see the kind of rich benefits that people that are my age will enjoy as a result of what I think everybody recognizes is an unintended consequence of the system. PERS has estimated that today a full career employee with 30 years of service is retiring on average at about 106% of their final average salary, and that within the next 10 years that median will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 120% of final average salary. So this is not just a situation where rebalancing PERS involves taking money out of the pockets of employees who need the money. Obviously, we all can use as much money as someone is willing to pay us. This is a situation where there's a need to rebalance the system because something went seriously awry. And I thought it was interesting that Mr. Hartman said, well, you know, one thing that could happen is that the court would say, you know, those things that you did that decreased benefits, those are invalid, but those things that you did that increased benefits, those are a contract now and you can't change them. Court can do anything, I suppose, but the nature of a contract is that it is a voluntary agreement between two people to do something. one promising the other to do something, and it requires that there be a meeting of the minds. You don't have unintended contracts. It is impossible for the legislature. In fact, the presumption is that when the legislature passes a statute, it is not a contractual promise. And so the likelihood of the court saying that something is a contractual promise because you made a mistake and put it in the statute trying to save money, and they're going to pull a ha-ha gotcha, is very remote. But I think that tells volumes about the way that Mr. Hartman analyzes the contract. I said at the outset, he has told you that nothing you do that reduces the projected future benefits is lawful. And what he told you today is that this is an effort to take away $6 billion of benefits that have been promised to members. Let's get real about this. What we're talking about is not taking $1 of benefit out of a member account, not taking $1 of benefit that's being paid currently to PERS retirees. What we're talking about is reducing the projected future benefits, the actuary's estimate of what happens to benefits if we do nothing. That's what Mr. Hartman tells you is the contract, and under his theory, I think, if you take away $1 of projected future benefits, then you have breached a contract, which is one of the reasons why I find it interesting that the PERS coalition supported House Bill 2001, which certainly had an impact of reducing projected future benefits. That was the purpose for passing it. Prior to House Bill 2001, the PERS actuary estimated that crediting to Tier 1 member accounts would be an average of 8.5% a year. And you saved money because you said, no, it will never be more than 8%, and that reduced that half percent. That's where the savings came from, and it reduced projected future benefits. With regard to the 6%, Mr. Hartman quite correctly points out that the reason that you eliminate the 6% contribution is because it will slow down the impact of the money match. And he says it's not the requirement that we contribute 6% that's the contract, it's money match that is the contract. And I'm glad he brought that up because you need to know what the history of money match is. In 1953, when PERS was recreated as the public employees retirement system, it was what people in the pension industry refer to as a money purchase plan. The law said, employee, you put up X percent of your income, and the employer will match that percent. And whatever you have at the end of your career as a result of those contributions and the interest that you earn, that's what you get. Classic, what we think of as a 401k type plan. In about 1967, the legislature adopted a new formula, which was called the pension plus annuity. And they eliminated the old way of calculating benefits and the old contribution requirements. And they said from now on, members contribute 6% and they get whatever that earns. And the employer will provide, that was the annuity part, and the employer will provide a pension that was a formula, a lower formula than the formula that you have in the statutes now, but when combined with the 6%, that was the retirement benefit that would be received. That replaced the old system. 2 years later, the Public Employees Retirement Board came to the legislature and they said, you know, we made a little bit of a mistake because there actually are some long-term employees who have been in the system for a very long time who would receive more under the old money purchase plan than they receive under the pension plus annuity. And it's not really fair that we take away something that they've already earned, so we want to grandfather them. What the legislature did to grandfather them was to pass what is now known as the money match. And the legislature, quite frankly, made two mistakes. They did not limit it to people that were in the system as of 1967. And instead of saying that you will get at least an equal contribution to what you contribute, the classic match of contributions that existed before, they said you'll get at least double what's in your account. Now, we all have to live with that, those mistakes, because the legislature made them. But when you are analyzing whether the legislature intended to make a promise to somebody who went to work in 1995 or somebody that started with the system in 1985, it is clear from the legislative history that the legislature never intended to promise that a system would double what was in their account and then annuitize it on the basis of outdated mortality tables to provide a pension in excess of what they were earning before they retired. That was not what the legislature intended. And to say that that's a contract that must be protected is ignoring the reality that what is a contract is sometimes different than the pure words of the statute that the legislature will enforce. There's no doubt that a member who retires today is entitled to retire under the money match if that's the highest benefit. But there is a very serious question about whether the legislature could eliminate the money match benefit on a going forward basis, protecting the accrued rights, the accrued benefits to date, but saying you're not going to accrue anymore. And in effect, that's what happens when you, at least to a large extent, not completely, when you say we're no longer going to have you put money in your account. With respect to the 8% guarantee, Mr. Hartman, I think, oversimplifies, and he accuses me of making things too complex, and I guess I accuse him of making things too simple. I would suggest to you that when somebody as knowledgeable and as experienced as Mr. Hartman in the PERS system tells you that something about PERS is simple, it's time to hang on to your wallet. The 8% guarantee was at issue in the OSPOA case, and the court did hold that it was a contractual promise. But it was dealing with a ballot measure promoted by Mr. Sizemore and adopted by the people that said, effective today, there will no longer be an 8% guarantee. That's dramatically different than what this bill does, which continues the 8% guarantee, or more accurately, the assumed rate guarantee, and assures that no one who is in Tier 1, who is the beneficiary of that promise, will retire with an account balance that is less than the accumulated interest rate credited to their account. Mr. Hartman says that that this bill is dependent upon the Lipscomb opinion, and that was a fair criticism of House Bill 2003 as it was initially introduced. It is not a fair criticism of House Bill 2003A. This bill stands independent of what happens in the Lipscomb case. The only thing that ties this case to the Lipscomb decision is the remedy, and as I pointed out, that remedy will only be implemented if PERS is required to implement the Lipscomb decision. This bill contains its own legislative findings about the mistakes of the past. And finally, two final things. Mr. Hartman says, well, it's only an average 4.5% increase in rate that's anticipated in 2003 if you do nothing. Let's not get confused about that, because it's easy to, when you talk about percentage points, to lose sight of what you're talking about. That's not 4.5% increase. That's an increase of 4.5% of payroll, each percentage point equal to about $64 million across the system. And compared to the current rates, that's a 30% increase in rates in one biennium. And we all know that the problem isn't what happens in the next biennium. The problem is what happens in the next three bienniums, when contribution rates are projected to go to as high as 30% of payroll in order to pay benefits that the legislature never intended to provide. And finally, Mr. Hartman says, look, this is no different than any other defined benefit plan across the country. We're really sucking air because of the down market. And there's no question, I mean, we both agree that the poor market performance is a significant reason why we're in the trough that we're in. My clients, the eight cities that brought the City of Eugene case, filed the lawsuit in 1999, before the market went in the tank, at a time when earnings were going through the roof in the PERS fund, because their rates were dramatically increased and they couldn't figure out how employer contribution rates could go up in an up market. And the reason is because PERS, unlike any other retirement plan that anybody can describe to you anywhere in the country and probably anywhere in the world, has the best of both worlds or the worst of both worlds, depending on your perspective. In up markets, employees get all the benefit of the upside. We earned 20% in 1999. 22% will give employees in Tier 1 20%. The next year, the money goes away. You said we lost $7 trillion in the stock market. That money goes away. The employees don't lose that money. In fact, they get 8% on top of it. That's why the system is in trouble.
Senator Walker.
Mr. Gary, wouldn't you agree that employers want the right to invest their money in variable accounts so they could capitalize on the high interest market rate? Employers got to go into the variable account. Would you agree?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, the board has passed a rule that allows employers to match the investments in the variable. And that, to some extent, it's not, in my view, the correct solution, and it wasn't the correct solution in Judge Lipscomb's view either, because we believe that PERS has been miscalculating the money match benefit with respect to variables. But
the issue here is that you just keep hammering away that the employees are getting all the benefits. The employers got something out of this, too. Didn't they? And when employers pay the 6%, do they pay payroll taxes on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, no, they don't pay payroll taxes on it, neither do the employees. That's why the pickup was described when it was adopted as a win-win, because it allowed employees to keep more of their pay and it allowed employers to avoid having to pay the roll-ups. There's no question about that.
Thank you.
Mr. Gary, one final question. There's been some discussion in the building about the transition accounts contemplated in 2003. Do you have any concerns about the tax-exempt status of those accounts?
Mr. Chair, no, but the reason I don't have any concerns about the tax-exempt status of those accounts is because pension lawyers far more knowledgeable than I about the tax consequences have assured me that they have no concerns about it. There are some hoops that will need to be jumped through in order to make sure that it is a tax-qualified plan, but my understanding is that that can be done. And although it may take more time than until July 1 for that to be completed, it can be done on a retroactive basis once the approval is obtained from the Internal Revenue Service.
And can one say the same thing about if there were a successor plan that is the hybrid plan, that 6% would fall into the same category of being safe in terms of tax-exempt status?
I assume, Mr. Chair, that any hybrid plan that this body approves as a successor system will have as an essential component of it that it meets the necessary requirements to pass muster with the IRS.
I just wanted to get that on the record because it's been a question in the building. Go ahead, Mr. Hartman.
Just a couple of quick thoughts, and then I do want to raise one issue that I neglected where Mr. Gary and I believe agree, just to end this discussion. I don't want to get into a debate with Mr. Gary about contract rights. We're going to have that opportunity in a few months or somewhere down the road in the courts. But I do want to point out, I found it interesting at one point when he said that the contract made by the legislature may be different than the legislative language. Now, I'm not quite sure how you discern a contract which is different from what the legislature said in their language. And I guess I go back to certain basic principles that the court has adhered to, which says that when interpreting statutes, we'll look at the language. And if the legislature has told us to do something, that's what we're going to do. So I find it rather remarkable that we can somehow go beyond the language and find some different contract. I'm not quite sure how that works. Just one point of clarification. Mr. Gary reflected on the fact that rates had gone up in 97 and 99. I believe he is in part incorrect. Rates did go up in 97, but that was primarily because of the passage of House Bill 3349 by this body, which was, in fact, dealing with the tax issue, which arose in the early 90s. So to the extent that rates went up, it was because of legislative action primarily. And in 1999, rates, for the most part, went down throughout the system, although there are some circumstances where some individual employers saw their rates go up. So there were some up, but primarily rates were down in 99 because of the fact that we did have good earnings. And let me turn to the other topic, and this I see has been drafted in a -11 amendment, and this has to do with the direct appeal to the Supreme Court, and at some point, and at my understanding, I was not present, but that when this was being reviewed in Ways and Means, the word exclusive was put back in the bill, which would make the direct appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court the exclusive remedy for dealing not only with constitutional issues, but issues related to contract breach. I believe Mr. Gary and I are in agreement that that's not a good idea. He can speak for himself, but we did talk beforehand. I would simply point out to you that the process of going directly to the Supreme Court will answer the big questions about whether there are constitutional or contract difficulties with this legislation. It's not really designed to remedy every single issue that may come up, because some of those issues may not become obvious for some period of time. Also, if this word exclusive were left in here, the only way that I could protect my clients in their breach of contract would be to file a class action claim directly in the Supreme Court, which would not only be a class action of PERS participants, but a class of PERS employers. The Supreme Court is simply not set up to deal with that kind of litigation. I mean, they just, unlike a trial court that has a whole means of dealing with that, the Supreme Court is simply not prepared to deal with that. To the extent that all of us want quick answers, and I think that's universally the case about whether there's legal troubles, I think placing the word exclusive in there is counterproductive, because it makes us raise issues which otherwise we simply don't have to raise. So I would strongly encourage you, I think with Mr. Gary's support, to remove the word exclusive, and that does appear in amendments apparently drafted as A11.
To his credit, Mr. Gary actually said that that was part of the package, and it is pulled out.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hartman and I reached that agreement, I just recalled, in this room on House Bill 2004, and so I don't know that there was anybody that was deliberately making a change. I think it just may have not gotten into this bill, but that is the agreement that we had on that language.
Thank you, Senator Miss.
Well, I understand the argument that the Supreme Court's not set up to deal with that, but give me an example of some issues that you would include if exclusive stayed there that you would otherwise not put it in.
Senator Minnis, it's not so much issues, it's the procedure. For instance, let's just take the 6% issue, the doing away with employee contributions. The court may well determine that that's constitutional, but a breach of contract. And by doing so, what they would determine then is that each person before the court is entitled to some remedy, some dollar damages remedy. And as Mr. Gary pointed out, they may well just be calculating their benefits that they otherwise would have gotten had the legislature not acted. The problem is, if you make the process of going to the Supreme Court the exclusive remedy, then I have to bring along all 300,000 PERS participants into that lawsuit to assure that whatever remedy the court comes up with is going to be a remedy that's available to them. Now, the way I do that, of course, is to file a class action. So it's not that different issues will be raised in the Supreme Court. It's just that procedurally, the only way I can protect my clients would be to go through that process. Now, if it's not exclusive, in other words, if you leave that word out, we can simply do a test case. We can take 10 or 15 participants, let the court decide what the rules are going to be, and then presumably those rules will apply to everybody, and if they don't, we still have the opportunity to go into circuit court to enforce those. But the decision will be made at the Supreme Court level about what is or is not a breach of contract or is not an impairment of contract.
Well, I need to think about that. Quite frankly, I think the Supreme Court should have exclusive jurisdiction. I think the entire issue should be sitting in front of them. I think it's about time they got out of their usual modality.
I think, Senator, they might pull their hair out if you do that. But
probably we're pulling our hair out now.
I understand that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up on that?
Briefly.
Very briefly. I'm way behind on an interview. Mr. Hartman, wouldn't it drastically increase litigation costs if you had to file a class action lawsuit and involve all members rather than do a test case?
Yes. And even more significantly, the time taken with dealing with class issues. For instance, we did this when we were involved with the litigation involving the imposition of tax by the legislature back in the early 90s. And my recollection is it took us probably 6 months to a year to deal with class issues before we could even get to substance. So while I would have a concern about the additional costs, more importantly, from all our perspective, it may slow us down substantially.
Right.
And so that's a more significant concern.
Okay. That was what I thought your answer would be. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Nelson? Mr. Linden? We're pretty far behind, so whatever you can do to be brief would be greatly appreciated.
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Bill Linden representing the Oregon PERS Retiree Inc. Association. Just a little background on this group. It was formed in the early 90s in response to a legislative decision to tax pensions of retirees. In that context, this group organized, raised funds, initiated litigation, and was resoundingly successful in that litigation. Today, they have 9,800 members in every community in this state. We're here today to talk to you about two amendments that we want you to consider to House Bill 2003A. And we think these address a fairly straightforward issue, and that is simply the issue of Section 9, Section 10, and Section 14A of the A engrossed House bill. In statute right now, there are provisions that set in place a process for the PERS board to determine the amount of a cost of living adjustment for retirees and how that cost of living adjustment is to be paid. Two sentences in statute really govern this. They say, after January 1 each year, the board shall determine the percentage increase or decrease in the cost of living based on the consumer price index. And the second sentence says, prior to July 1 each year, the allowance to which the member is entitled or receiving shall be adjusted by that amount. In analyzing the impact of 2003A on this statute, we think that clearly there is a benefit conferred to retirees, and that is the annual cost of living adjustment, and that this benefit is promised to them by the clear language of the statute. By freezing the COLAs for a period of time, and it doesn't matter the reason why you're freezing the COLAs. What matters is the effect of 2003A in freezing the COLAs. We believe that this benefit that was promised will not be provided and that this will result in an impairment of the contract. The Dash 8 amendments would correct the situation by deleting Sections 9 and 10 of the bill. The Dash 10 amendments would delete Section 14A, which is the remedy, a part of the remedy piece tied to the Lipscomb or the City of Eugene case. And we would urge adoption of these amendments to take this issue out of this bill because we think clearly it's going to result in an impairment of a contract that the retirees have, and would urge your favorable consideration.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Nelson, also representing Oregon PERS Retirees, Inc. Just to focus just briefly on and to add what Bill has already said, and you've seen some of these quotes in terms of some of the previous testimony, but I'd just like to emphasize in the Oregon State Police case, in referencing earlier cases, they cited one earlier case which stated, when there has been a full performance on the part of the plaintiff, her rights became vested and no subsequent change in bylaws could interfere with or impair such rights, any other rule would utterly destroy all stability and security in the retirement plan. Further on in that case, they stated, once the employee performs services in reliance on the employer's promise to afford a particular benefit on retirement, the employee is contractually bound to honor that obligation. Finally, it was also stated in that case, once offered and accepted, a pension promise made by the state is not a mirage, something seen in the distance that disappears before the employee reaches retirement. Nullification of an express term of plaintiff's PERS contract with the state is an impairment for the purposes of a contract. Mr. Chairman, a contract has been entered into by the retirees. They have been awarded a very specific pension. There is no other issue that we have found on both sides of this issue in terms of this body and your brethren in this legislature that drives people more to feel that this is an inequity. It's not fair to take an existing retiree's pension plan and to, in effect, reduce that plan after they've retired. We believe is unfair, is inequitable, and they have a right to something more than a mirage. And we believe that right was there when they retired, and we believe that right will be there if this bill goes forward, if it has to go to the court. We truly ask you on this one particular measure, and you know, Mr. Chairman, we have other concerns and other clients as it relates to other parts of this measure, but we believe this is fundamentally inequitable and that this change should be made. Thank you.
Well, with all due respect, I passed along a sheet of paper yesterday to five people and it had four words on it. It had, four choices, 2%, 6%, 8%, and look back with interest. And I had the five people rate the potential illegality of each one of those, you know, the potential for being thrown out by the Supreme Court, and not one of the five people had the same answer for each one. So, you know, there are a lot of lawyers in this one and a lot of opinions, but I appreciate the fact that I think it was, just from a personal standpoint, that 2% was really tough. But there was also an argument made, and I believe an argument of fairness, that those who were unlawfully enriched, that's a Lipscomb, you know, decision, not mine, should be the ones that should be responsible to pay it back, or to in this case, not pay it back, but to have the COLA frozen in order to catch up. And, you know, I understand you have to represent your clients. I understand that you're involved in other aspects of this bill. And I understand that, the PERS Coalition hates this bill. It's very clear to me. But that's the reason that's in there is, regarding sort of a fairness principle, so that the burden of having to deal with that unlawful adjustment was not placed on employees who did not gain the benefit.
And Mr. Chairman, and I'm not a lawyer, for me, it's not an issue of who's going to win this on appeal. It's an issue about what's right. This isn't right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I believe these people are in the overflow room. Adrian Weller, Marjorie Sandoz, Ed Summers, Peggy Peterson, Troy Hoagland. Oh, they're here. Okay, great. Could we have maybe three of you at a time? We've got how many folks? Can I see by a show of hands how many folks wanted to testify today? Okay. So we'll put you up next then. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. My name is Adrian Weller. I'm a retiree from OHSU and a member of the Ask Me Retirees group. And I was for 25 years an office worker up there, and I consider this PERS attack kind of like being Alice in Wonderland. This is a state budget crisis because large corporations are not taxed. PGE is only the most visible example of what isn't being paid into our coffers. The PERS problems are not the cause of the shortfall. Even the Oregonian finally admitted that. They said not mostly or even at all on Saturday's paper. It was finally to get them finally to say that. It was very interesting. Workers are being targeted at all stages. We're having our jobs, our wages, our health care, our schools, and our PERS cut, and yet we're not the problem. We've earned this money. We've contributed to it. We have a right to use it. And yet a number of legislators are very proudly, and some reluctantly, I'll give them that, but they're still there doing it, working to destroy PERS. And it will hurt current and future workers. And I think future workers, unlike myself, have as much or more at stake than I do as a retiree. They have a right to have a decent retirement to look forward to. This is an infrastructure question for the entire state, hundreds of thousands of people. So I'm saying to you folks, don't do it. I get 69% of a salary I made as an office worker. I pay $400, over $400 a month for health benefits, and I am taxed 30% on my salary. Prescriptions and health care are going through the roof. We need our COLAs. And people that are older than me obviously are going to need it more than I do. Don't put the public workers' money in 401ks. I mean, that is like, you know, throwing oil on the on a fire. It's unstable. The market is not the place to go for security. The market does not provide a stable funding, or we wouldn't be in this mess. Partly it's the market. Partly it's you guys have got to tax the large corporations. Stop hitting us in the pocket, all us workers. Stop hitting the small businesses in the pocket. Go after the big guys. They've got our money. They use our state services, but they don't pay anything back.
You and I have more in common than you think.
Well, then let's do something about it. 100,000 of people are going to come forward, hundreds of thousands, if you really do this and start hurting us. This is like the action of bullies. We may look small and weak, and those big corporations may look very big, but we're more the heart of the state than they are. And I just need you to stop doing this and start looking at taxing the corporations.
Thank you very much.
My name is Marjorie Sandoz. I live in Portland, and I am a retired school counselor. I retired in the year 2000 after 27 years of service in public education. I'm proud of the work that I did, and I deserve an adequate, secure pension. And so does every single working person in this state, whether they worked in the public or the private sector. My pension, by the way, is 67% of my final salary, not the 105% that is falsely bandied about in the press. I do not believe for one second, and it sounds like you don't either, that the PERS system is the cause of the fiscal ills in Oregon. Corporations have been given every conceivable form of tax break over the years, and now the public coffers are empty. The legislature must get corporate taxes back to a realistic level. When 58,000 corporations in Oregon pay only $10 a year to the state, how can you cut pensions to balance the state budget? The legislature should defend the pensions of working people, public education, health care, and funds for medications. Where's the legislation that will increase corporate taxes? They're the ones with all the money. Instead of trying to save money by slashing services to workers, have the courage to increase the funding to pay for services. Thank you.
I guess one thing I would point out is, I mean, I basically agree with both of you on the corporate aspect of it, but the one thing that I've really struggled with in this, and believe me, I've struggled really hard on this, is that I really believe that the system itself, take all this other stuff aside, you know, the economic crisis and the fact that workers' wages and benefits have been attacked, their collective bargaining rights have been attacked for years. I understand that. I've been here for 5 terms and watched it up close and personal. But I came to the conclusion that the system was in crisis. That's, you know, I just want you to understand that, you know, my view, you might think that other people who helped design this were doing it punitively towards public employees. I was not. My view was that the system was in crisis.
I think it's a crisis of perception. Problems don't equal a crisis unless you've got mixing public relations.
Well, $16 billion is $16 billion.
Well, look at all the money that the taxes haven't been given from the large corporations. You could look back.
I understand.
You have a bigger problem, but nobody's looking at that.
I understand. Okay. Are any of the other people on the list that I called here? Okay. Yes, you weren't on here, though. I just left it to the union representatives to bring. They just said they wanted to bring folks in, so we didn't have a sign-up list.
Well, my name is Rosalie Pedroza from Turner, Oregon, and I'm not here representing my union, although I am a member of Oregon Public Employees Union, and I'm also not here representing my agency as I work for Department of Human Services. I'm here as a private citizen. And I'm here today to ask you to vote no on referring House Bill 2003 to the Senate floor. I have worked for the state for almost 16 years. When I started, my wages were so low my kids and I qualified for food stamps. Rather than apply for them, I took a second job, which I worked for 3.5 years. It's nerve-wracking here. until my son was killed in a car accident, and I no longer had the mental strength to keep doing that. Since I no longer had kids at home, they cut my food budget to the bare bones to make ends meet. Excuse me.
You're doing fine. Take your time.
In 1990, I returned to school after 6 years of full-time work in school. I received my bachelor's degree from Oregon State University. I am now working on my master's degree. I have been promoted twice and am currently at the top step of my classification. Thank you. Oh, I think I'll do okay. Thanks, Mary. I do make enough now to pay my bills and buy food, but not much more. It is clear that the bulk of the employees in the state are not making a decent wage. When we were hired on, we knew we wouldn't get rich doing the work we love, but we're promised after years of service we would retire with a reasonable pension for our years of sacrifice. The media has said the bulk of us under the current system, those hired prior to 1996 will retire with over 100% of our wages. But that is very misleading. Sure, there are those at the high wage end or those with over 30 years of service who may, but the bulk of us will not. The PERS system was set up to benefit employees. While I do agree there needs to be some tweaking of the system, I believe this bill all out guts it. Every provision of this bill hurts us. Is that the thanks we get for keeping this state running? After all, we teach our kids, repair the roads and bridges to keep commerce running, take care of the poorest Oregonians, including senior citizens, who have given their lives to building better communities. Watch over the mentally ill, disabled, and prisoners to keep them and our communities safe, keep our water and air clean, preserve our parks so we can enjoy the recreational activities, and protect our homes from fires and other emergencies, and the list goes on and on. I'm angry that this legislature has decided to balance the budget on the backs of the people who keep the state running. There are fewer of us now carrying an increasing burden of work. You are not only asking us to accept no pay increase now, but are asking us to sacrifice the benefits we were promised in the future. That is wrong, and I'm asking you to please do the right thing and vote no. Thank you.
Rosalie, let me ask you a question. When you started to work for the state and you had the pension plan explained to you, what did you think you were going to get at the end? Did you think you were going to work 30 years and get 50% and be done?
I didn't know exactly, but I thought I'd get at least 75% with Social Security.
So, and you realize that that's preserved in the bill?
I don't believe that. I mean, you may say it, but I don't believe it.
Well, the full formula is still in the bill.
I think you're screwing us, frankly.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify? Close the session. Did you want to testify?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Open hearing 2003.
My name is Aaron Cook, and I'm a teacher at Lebanon High School. I'm not here representing my union or my affiliation. I'm here as, I guess, a slightly different perspective than what I've heard being brought forward. I am a Tier 1 member, but I am basically probably the last 1 or 2 months into the system, so I have a long time to look forward for this. What I'm concerned about is while there's a chance in this bill to take away benefits, sort of percentage-wise, I understand they are changing back to the structure that might have been here in the 50s or might have been in the 60s without the money match aspect. What I am concerned about is, as a teacher, who is going to be working with me in the future? And the reason for that is there are very few reasons for a person to get into the educational field at this time. Reason being, with the salary schedules as they are, and with basically a requirement of a master's degree to teach in Oregon, the current licensing structure, you're looking at a person accepting a job that pays significantly less than almost any other position they would take if they're working in the area that they have a master's degree for, a master's degree in engineering or a master's degree in almost any other field. If you work in that, would pay substantially more than what a teacher would make. Beyond that, with the change in property costs in Oregon, what happens over time is most public employees that are the working class public employees, including teachers, are looking at not being able to afford housing and their regular, what most people look at as a comfortable life on one salary, so they're forcing both members of the household to work. I'm concerned that that trend is going to increase, and that what will happen is that eventually people will not look into going into the teaching field. What that leaves then are people who are unable to get employed in other areas, people that have been in the field for a long time, and what we're going to have to be encouraging them to stay longer and longer, both because the retirement benefits have been reduced, but also because we don't have replacement teachers for that. What I would ask this body to look at when they consider that is, what are the conditions of other states in their teaching crises? We see all the time on the East Coast and areas in the Southeast where they just don't have enough teachers. One of the primary reasons is that it doesn't pay enough to attract people, and that the benefit packages have been reduced since the mid-80s all the way forward to now. I've been teaching for 8 years, and when I look back to where contracts were then, they have been a constant erosion through the bargaining process to date. However, this year, in bargaining in Lebanon, I've seen some of the worst cuts I have ever seen in a bargaining contract. And the idea is that that's going to be continuing throughout for at least the next three bienniums. What we look at with that is, at what point do people start looking at not wanting to teach anymore because there's simply not a future in it? This bill is one of the keystones in looking at that type of a plan, the idea that people really no longer want to get into a profession because there's simply not an equivalent payoff. Coming out of a college education, sometimes $30,000 to $40,000 in debt or more, depending on where you go. A state school, most of the people that come out of school currently and get teaching, I ask them, they're $30,000 to $40,000 in education debts. And then when you look at even ways of moving that around so that they can pay that off or have it deferred or however you can by working in a lower income district, what you end up with is still being in very, very severe financial situations and credit issues. Whereas, you know, they see people they worked with who probably didn't even get a master's degree, have a bachelor's degree, going into business related fields and being able to pay their bills just fine. I would ask you to consider this as one of the different criteria of a stepping stone of what's happening to public employees, not just teaching. And will people be willing to take the jobs that you have to offer in a few years when it's not just the benefits package, when it's on top of a salary schedule that's been reduced and everything else? And do you want those positions, or do you want people to actually take those positions? If education, or especially quality education, is something that's important to the state of Oregon, they need to look at this more so than just, this is just the retirement package, because it's not. It's one piece of several different issues that are coming down from the state of the market so that people can no longer really afford to get into the profession. It's one of those things you say, can I have a family? Can I feed my family? Can I buy a home? If I can't do it becoming a teacher, but I can do it in other fields with the same amount of education or less, then that's most likely the way some people are going to go. Now, we all got into teaching because we love it, but at some point we have to say, can we do it? And I think that's something you need to consider. So I would urge you to vote against this bill.
Sir, let me ask you a question since you bring up bargaining, current bargaining. The testimony that we heard was that within, I don't know how many years, I think it was 4 years, we could be looking at 30% contribution, 30% of payroll contribution for PERS. Typically in bargaining, the OPE, the other personnel expenses, are around 35%. Mm-hmm. We had a 19% increase in health insurance escalation last year. I think that's the, I don't know if that's a PEB average or whether that's a nationwide or statewide average, but we all know that medical inflation is going crazy. I guess I'm getting to the question of sustainability. I mean, if you're bargaining, and, you know, this is a hell of a time to be bargaining, and this, you know, I understand that, but can you see the nexus, and can you talk about how you feel about the fact that if we don't do something to reduce the 30%, that there is nothing to bargain for health care?
I would be happy to mention that. I think, first of all, one of the things that needs to be considered is that this particular cut in the PERS, I personally think is a little bit too drastic in one step. I think we need to look at, you know, maybe something a little more incremental in that, and also looking at what are we going to do about people that are getting into the system now as a different plan. And I know there is legislation currently going through the works about creating a different plan, not necessarily PERS for those. What I think is necessary is to not just look at, well, we have control over PERS directly, because the legislature has control over several things. One of the things that they have not looked, or they have not directly looked into until this session, was how do we deal with health care on a different level? If there's a way, I mean, Lebanon's went up 23% in 1 year. Mm-hmm. The district I was at prior to Lebanon, that was just basically 26% and 22% prior to that. That, in an accrued basis, is nearly 100% in 3 years, and yet this, we seem to be focusing much more on the retirement benefit package of it than we are of what can we do with health care. And I think that's something that when we are going to a bargaining situation, we have to look at. Some districts are better off in bargaining for their health care than others. Portland's, I mean, realistically, people talk about Portland having 10 days they worked for free. We compared out the cost of what they got and the difference of their the package that they have for health care versus ours in Lebanon. Basically, they got out 5 days less than we did. I mean, we're working the days, but we're getting so much less in health care that it equates out for about that in wages. What I think is important when we start looking at those is we have to look across the board and see how could we do it incrementally against that. I mean, when you're looking at the raises, we're taking basically, you know, a 1% raise over the next couple of years in Lebanon, and that's just flat. Inflation doesn't do that, so basically we're taking a cut in pay every year. And while I do understand that the state has to do something if they're looking at a PERS contribution of 30%, I think they need to look at some other issues, especially those people who are, you know, retiring with 110% benefit. The state average is 68. So while I do understand people coming in and saying that there are these people in a certain window that will be making a huge benefit because of what they've done over the certain years and when they got in and what the market did at that time period, I would ask you, you know, to consider that that's not the average. 108% is not the average across the state. I mean, we can argue about where the figures came from. Mine are coming from OEAs, and I grant you that that may not be entirely accurate, but it's paid to be quite accurate, and it's 68%.
I'm going with the numbers here.
So I am a little bit concerned when you say that, yes, it will be 30% kicking, and we do need to do something about that. I don't know the exact answer. What I would say is that this is one more reason why here college students and I have to go back to keep working on my education, saying that, yes, they were going into education, but they're not anymore. I don't have the answer. I'm just trying to give you one piece that you need to consider when you do this. And I can see that we need to look at a different way for health care, and we also need to look at a different situation here for PERS. But I think looking at those people who are, I guess, graduating from PERS with 110% might be a place to start, not the people that are starting with 68.
Thank you very much. Good job. Anybody else? We're adjourned. Thank you, colleagues.